Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to recap some of our most intriguing and interesting Mind Moments podcast episodes of 2023 with snippets of conversations that we had with experts in neurology. Let's dive in. First, in early February, following the immediate accelerated approval of lecanemab, an anti-amyloid therapy for patients with Alzheimer's disease, we spoke with Sharon Cohen, a behavioral neurologist and medical director of the Toronto Memory Program. Cohen shared her thoughts on the safety of lecanemab, including the risk of amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, and how clinicians should prepare for this new agent. Here's what she had to say.
And it's important that the community at large understand that we take deaths and adverse events very seriously within trials, and I know that ASI does as well. So any death or serious event is reviewed carefully in terms of, attribution. Is it caused by the drug? Is it caused by a variety of factors or something completely unrelated to the drug? What we know from the large phase 3 study is that there were no deaths related to ARIA in people on lecanemab. There was one fatal hemorrhage in a person on placebo. And we do see hemorrhage infrequently, but we do see it as part of Alzheimer's disease. And so it's important that people understand that in Alzheimer's disease, the vessels are leaky. We can have hemorrhage, and that does occur rarely in the disease without any treatment, without any lecanemab or other anti-amyloid. We also see microhemorrhage, often asymptomatic, but not infrequently. We see these little spots of bleeding in the brain in people with Alzheimer's just by virtue of having Alzheimer's disease. So the question is, adding lecanemab, based on the propensity for bleeding in the brain, does that enhance bleeding? Only a very, very small amount. And so if you can get benefit and slowing of disease with only a very slight increase in risk of bleeding, many patients will feel, hey, this is Alzheimer's, I'll take that risk. Others will say, no, that's not for me. So an informed discussion is very important. Mm-hmm. With the three deaths that were reported, and there's been a lot of hype about it, it's really important that clear information comes out. One of the individuals was on an anticoagulant that has its own risk of bleeding and was a person who has falls. That also, if you're on an anticoagulant and you hit your head, you get more bleeding. Now, they were in the open label extension, so they were also on lecanemab, but it's not clear to me that it was entirely lecanemab. They had other reasons for bleeding in the brain. The second patient reported, and reported in a very dramatic way, was one who had a stroke. She was also in the open label lecanemab study, had gotten all the way through to the open label extension. And she had a stroke, not due to lecanemab, and was given a clot busting drug, TPA, which has a 6% risk of causing bleeding. And when you bleed from TPA in the brain, there's about a 45% chance that that bleed will be fatal. So to say that lecanemab caused that, to me, is not credible. She was given a clot-busting drug, which itself could have caused the bleed. Did lecanemab contribute to that? Is that combination unsafe? We're trying to figure that out, and nobody wants to be dismissive here. The third case, again, somebody in the open label extension on lecanemab. We don't have all the details. I believe they were on anticoagulant as well. And ASI is trying to get the details before we get in this hype about, blaming the drug versus blaming something else. Let's get the medical information. So we don't know yet. I think that the information's important. We need to lay it out in a scientific manner and not let it play out in the media. Unfortunately, that's what happens with some of the drama in drug development, and that doesn't serve our patients or our community well. But there will be appropriate use guidelines being developed to guide treating physicians to use lecanemab in the safest possible way. And there may be patients, for example, on anticoagulants or who have the genetic genotype of two copies of APOE4, who may be at higher risk of bleeding. And therefore, that risk-benefit discussion has to happen between clinician and patient. And that will ensure that we keep people safe.
If you want to hear more of that special episode, click the link in the show notes. Next, we're going to hear from Robert A. Hauser, director of the Parkinson's and Movement Disorders Center at the University of South Florida. In late January, Hauser sat down to discuss the current state of therapeutics in Parkinson's disease, some of the lingering challenges in day-to-day management, the promise of novel agents in development, such as IPX203, and more. In this clip, he discussed the advantages of IPX203 over traditional carbidopa-levodopa formulations and how it may be integrated into the field pending its approval.
So, in clinic, what I do is when I'm talking to a patient, I'll ask them, what happens when you take levodopa? First of all, does it provide benefit? And for most Parkinson's patients, they'll say, yes, I see benefit when you put me on it. My slow and small movement, my small steps improved, et cetera. And then I'll say, well, is it lasting from dose to dose? Again, if they're on the carbidopa, levodopa, immediate release. And I'm looking to hear, yes, it's lasting from dose to dose, or no, it kind of wears off before the next dose. And if it's wearing off before the next dose, well, how long does it last? How much time is there that it's worn off before the next dose kicks in? And then I'm thinking about, well, how much difficulty is that causing for you? Is it just something you noticed, or is it causing an issue? Are you having trouble performing activities? Is it causing trouble with mobility, et cetera? And the other part of it is, how long is it taking to kick in? Because the nerves to the GI system are also affected by Parkinson's disease. So patients get gastroparesis, takes longer for the pill to get past the stomach to the small bowel. So the time it takes to kick in becomes longer and more variable. So when patients have this off time, then I'm thinking about what my options are, and an extended release levodopa, carbidopa may be a good option. And IPX203, it's medication in development, as you implied, and it comes in capsule form, and these capsules have granules that have immediate release carbidopa and levodopa in them. That represents 25% of the levodopa, and 75% is in extended release beads. And these beads have a polymer coating, or polymer coatings, really. One is an extended release polymer coating, and one is a mucoadhesive polymer coating. And what that means is, once the capsule gets down past the stomach and into the small bowel, the levodopa in these beads tends to, number one, get anchored to the small intestine. So it spends a longer time in the area where it gets absorbed. And because of the coating, it gets dissolved or available for absorption slowly. So it spends a longer time in the bowel where it gets absorbed. And because of the slow release, there's longer time that it gets absorbed. So that translates into a longer duration of benefit per dose. And that's what the development program was all about.
If you want to hear more of that convo, check out episode 81 in the show notes. Our next guest is Dr. Alberto Espe, the Division Director and Research Endow Chair of the James J. and Joan A. Gardner Family Center for Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders at the University of Cincinnati. Shortly after the FDA gave lecanemab traditional approval in June, he sat down to give his thoughts on the realistic impact the agent may bring to the Alzheimer's disease community and patients themselves. Here's Espe on why we need to temper our expectations with lecanemab and other anti-amyloid therapies.
These therapies are never going to work in the manner that we want them. We have to start moving away from finding anything that does something trivial. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that 20 years after the last approval of any medication by the FDA for Alzheimer's, we are now 20 years later approving something that is half of the benefit than the last drug that we approved yielded. That drug, donepezil, has a magnitude of efficacy that's twice as big as lecanemab. So I think we have to, in the future, we just need to stop accepting peanuts. It is not okay to peddle the concept that anything is better than nothing. No, that is just an indictment that we have not, the fact that we cannot get our we cannot have a success. This is not a success. This is not a success. This is the illusion of success. We have to just move out of this concept. The collected data in humans suggests that amyloid forms in reaction to a variety of things the brain is exposed to. Some are toxic exposures, some are infectious exposures, some are biological derangements. That's what amyloid does. It reacts. That's why it's all over the brain. It's not all over the brain so that we would have our own toxin to deal with, as opposed to having to borrow a toxin from the environment. No, this is a reaction to something. People who have herpes simplex virus encephalitis, they get lots of amyloid in the brains. If they're cured, the amyloid goes away. If they aren't, partially they recover, but harmed, they're going to have something that looks like Alzheimer's, but it's not because of it. That's the victim is because of the infection. The amyloid became a byproduct of that infection, a response to that infection. So we're in a weird period. I think this is so harmful that that we've accepted such puny outcomes. And companies are going to milk this one the best way they can. They're going to try to recover as much as they can, you know. And by the way, somebody like me, you would think my conflict of interest is will be very important for my hospital to give a lot of this out, because it'll be a financial windfall. Yeah. Infusions are very, very profitable to hospital systems. So me saying we shouldn't give this to patients is not quite, this is against my conflict of interest. My conflict of interest should allow me to, or should open me to the idea that, oh, well, doesn't look that good, but heck, it's approved by the FDA, must be safe and effective. And it's neither. It's neither safe nor effective. This is what I call the illusion of progress.
If you want to hear more of that conversation, check out episode 94 in the show notes. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Carolina Atusta, who discussed research on post-stroke epilepsy, the ongoing clinical efforts to manage seizures after stroke, and the studies needed to further the field. Atusta, a scientific researcher and clinical data manager at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, discussed the lack of standardized approach to monitoring post-stroke seizures, especially for elderly individuals.
Currently, there is no clear international guideline on how to manage and on the protocols for these patients with a stroke in terms of post-stroke seizures. For a stroke, there many international, very well-validated guidelines for every participant, for every case, but not for post-stroke epilepsy. However, individual institutions have protocols, and most of these protocols will definitely include a neurological assessment in the first days, in the first month after stroke, which is kind of the high-risk moment. So they will probably ask a bunch of questions, do a lot of tests, get a lot of imaging and analysis to see how the patient is recovering and if there's something else going on. So in this period, in the first month, even up to 3 months, some institutions will follow up these stroke patients up to 3 months, which is kind of part of the stroke protocol. And during this time, these participants will be asked about seizures and if there's something related to seizures that could be going on. However, after these acute and subacute kind of period, there's not really kind of a protocol determining how or like telling us what to do in order to like confirm or post-stroke seizures. some institutions, and again, this is, and I'll want to come back to this later, but like this, like in developing countries, I personally come from a developing country, and the follow-up of these participants is many times limited by the system itself. We lose participants. Basically, they go back to their cities, or they just go out of the system, or something happens. So in many places, the follow-up of patients with a stroke is stopped at 3 or 6 months after the stroke. So we don't have a protocol on what to do after that. However, in developing countries, and what we should be doing is be able to follow up these participants at least for 2 years after a stroke, either by telephone, email, something, and just make sure that we're asking about seizures. And why is it important to ask about seizures? Well, seizures after stroke it has been shown that it definitely affects the recovery, the motor recovery, and the behavioral recovery of those patients. Management itself, so in case the patient is receiving anti-seizure medication, these types of medication could affect or could interfere with stroke, secondary prevention for stroke, with the drugs that we use for secondary prevention. And thirdly, it affects the quality of life. It will limit their ability to drive. If it's a young woman, it will actually have the woman will probably have some childbearing concerns. So there are many factors that could impact the quality of life in this patient. And that's why it's important to be able to follow up until 1 or 2 years after the stroke.
If you want to hear more of that convo, check out episode 82 in the show notes. Finally, we're going to close things out with a snippet of our conversation from Dr. Natalie Goediger, a nurse practitioner at Washington University in St. Louis, who gave her immediate reaction to the FDA approval of SRP-9001, the first gene therapy for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Here's Goediger on the safety considerations prescribing clinicians should be aware of going forward as this agent enters the treatment landscape.
Because in the excitement, we have to also think about what the risk may be. So I think this product and any gene replacement therapy product has to be taken very seriously. We counsel our patients with any product like this that when a safety event occurs, we manage it as we're able to. So often that means immune suppressive medications, depending on what the event is. But we can't stop the medicine. We can't take it away like we can other medications. And so that's something that parents really need to think about and be aware of. The most common safety event we saw in trials was vomiting, occurred in about half the boys who received the medicine. Usually in about the first week or so, sometimes lasting a couple weeks, sometimes lasting weeks and weeks. That was rare, but it did happen. Next most common event and potentially more serious event was acute liver injury, occurred in about a third of boys, a couple of whom had serious adverse events, meaning they had to be hospitalized and usually were treated with intravenous steroids. There were a couple of cases of myocarditis and at least one patient with immune-mediated myositis who had an immune-mediated reaction and actually got weaker following treatment with this medication, which is part of why there is the contraindication in treating boys with a deletion of exons 8 to 9. So all of these events are potentially very serious or could be serious and warrant really close monitoring and follow-up in the immediate time points after dosing and ensuring that there's a really good family commitment to doing all the things that are asked of them, namely dosing steroids every day, following up with labs, any other testing before and after dosing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.